It's nice to be here. In academics, we don't usually get to speak to such large audiences. It's nice, and you actually look alert, too. So I'm going to talk about mechanics. It's not really quite a research talk. One version of this talk is a bunch of experiments that make Andy look kind of stupid. And the basic theme is maybe this word non-holonomic, which I will try to explain to you. So we're going to talk about cats turning over, astronauts, trucks, things like that, and two different uses of the word non-holonomic, which most people were like I was, I suppose, that it was just a scary word that you kind of avoided when you took mechanics classes, and so I want to take you back and show you some things about that. A little advertisement. We had a robot. That's the real work we do that broke the world's record for walking, went 14.3 miles. That's the other side of my life, which I talked about yesterday. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about this non-holonomic stuff. And here was my first exposure. So my background was in geophysics and rock mechanics and things like that. And that's what I was working on at the time in about 1984 when a guy named Tom Kane from Stanford came. He's an engineer who's a so-called dynamicist, somebody interested in dynamics. And he came and gave a talk at Cornell promoting something called Kane's equations, which are something like Lagrange equations. They're ways of writing down the equations of classical mechanics. And he gave this question to the audience, which I will give to you. I don't want you to shout out the answer to the question, but I will give you a chance to raise your hands and stuff like that. So the question is you're driving a car on a straight level road, and you have somehow a car with a special kind of brakes where you can freeze the front wheels and lock them and have the back wheels roll, or you can freeze the back wheels and have them skid and have the front wheels roll, and you're worried about the stability of the car. Now, cars have low center of mass, so you're not worried about the car tipping over. You're worried about whether the car is going to go straight or not after you slam on the brakes. So it's the better thing to do to slam on the front brakes or slam on the rear brakes. This is the puzzle that he gave to the audience. Okay, now, that audience, like you, mostly either don't know the answer or have the wrong answer, or you have some inside information. And I know what kind of inside information you have, those of you who have it. Just out of curiosity, who has an opinion about this to start with? Now, who knows the answer? Now, up here, you guys should know the answer. I bet there's some of you know the answer. No? So, the usual intuition is that, friction slows you down, and that you lock the rear brakes, it's sort of like a parachute, and it drags behind and makes the car go straight. And that might be the right answer, it might not be the right answer. So, in 1981, I had my first car. It was my first year as a professor at Cornell. And I knew that this car had the property that when you step on the brakes, it mostly activates the front brakes, and it's fun skidding. And I also knew that when you pull the emergency brake, in this case it was this cable, this ratchet sound, that it locks the rear wheels. And in this car, when you pull the emergency brake, it only locked the rear wheels. And I knew that. And I wasn't yet interested in dynamics, but for some reason I thought, what would happen if I was driving on a flat, straight road and I just skidded with the rear wheels? And it was an icy, flat road. I wasn't going very fast. Very safe situation. I was going, let's see, in your language, 8 meters per second or so. And I was just wondering what would happen. And I don't know why I was really wondering it, but car cost $70. It's a nice car. I have dreams about this car still. And I just totally lost control. I sort of forgot where the emergency brake was, and I'm steering like this, and it went over. And was hanging by my seatbelt, and I knew what happens then, what happens if you pull the emergency brake and just skid with the rear wheel. So Tom Kane there is giving this question to the audience, and people are sort of sitting there puzzled like that, and I was sitting somewhere over there, and I was going, I know. Me, I know the answer. Which I did know the answer. No, I didn't know anything about why. I'd done the experiment. So why does this work? So how do you get some intuition about this? So if you think of a car as something going along, I'm just trying to find some random object here. Here's this car moving along like this, and it's driving down the road. And wheels, you think of wheels as things that are trying to emulate no friction. But that is not really what wheels are about. They're trying to be very high friction in one direction and very low friction in the other. So one job of the wheels is to keep it easy to roll the car down the road. But another job of the wheels is to keep the car on the road. So if you imagine the car is supposed to be going like this, and there's a rear wheel like this, it's like an ice skate. It wants to go that direction. It doesn't want to go that direction. So there's a natural self-aligning that happens with wheels. So the intuition you can use is that it's like wheels are like the feathers on an arrow, and they cut in one direction and they don't go the other direction. And if you lock the brakes, it would be like putting a ping pong ball on an arrow. So to start with, just leave off the brakes and take friction out altogether. You're shooting an arrow. Which way is it more stable, with the feathers in the back or the front? Obviously the feathers go in the back, right? Straight as an arrow means like it goes right when the feathers are in the back. So if you lock the rear wheels and you leave the front wheels rolling, it's like putting feathers on the wrong end of an arrow. And there's a natural deflection of that front part. Meanwhile, the back wheels are locked. So there's friction there. So there's a drag like this on the rear wheels, but there's a drag on the front wheels, which is really like a lift in airplane talk. The friction force is perpendicular. This has a big lever arm to turn this, and this drag force has just a small lever arm. So it comes out unstable. Now, is that really the whole story completely, totally? No, it's not. When the speed gets very low, something different happens. But when you're going fast, sort of the faster you go, the smaller that friction force becomes in importance, and it just becomes like an arrow. And of course, you want the feathers in back, so you want to lock the front wheels and let the front let the back wheels roll. So it's like feathers. So if you took an arrow, I haven't actually done this experiment, but I imagine it works out. You put a ping pong ball in the front of an arrow, and it will still want to go straight with the ping pong ball in front, even if the ping pong ball is about as big as the feathers are. Okay, any questions about this so far? Now, who are the people who know this? I imagine there's some of you here. So when you watch TV shows and you watch car chases and these cars like going down the street and they screech and they turn around, how do they do that trick? Is they make a slight turn, they pull the emergency brake, and the car flips around and goes backwards. And then it's stable, moving with the rolling wheels in the back of the car, but those are the front wheels because the car's flipped around backwards. And then they let off the emergency brake and it goes shooting out. So some people must know that. So you know that. So there are other people who know that. There's a So the people who know this is something you can do good in this part of the country, do well in this part of the country, is you join the secret society of grocery store parking lot snowy night drivers. And it's a very secret society. The members don't even know each other. You recognize that there are other members because at 3 in the morning there are only so many people out there skidding on the parking lot. But those people, of which there must be some in this audience, raise your hand if you're right. So now you're the one. Okay. Those people must know this thing about the. Do any of you know the result from your parking lot? So you're shy. Okay. So how does this work if you want to analyze it? And again, this is sort of what Tom Kane talked about. You set up this mechanical system. Imagine this is a rigid object, which is sitting on this plane, and we're not worrying about it tipping over. We're just worried about this moving around on the plane. And to start with, it's free to move on the plane. And then you put an ice skate on the bottom that just protrudes a little bit. We're still not worried about tipping over. So the rest of this thing is frictionless on the ice. And then there's this ice skate, and it's a figure skate. It's not a racing skate. So it allows this thing to move this point, to move this direction, but it freely twists like a figure skate. And then you take this rigid object and you put it on a plane, and you say, how can it move? Now, if you didn't have this gate here, how does it move? It moves in a straight line at a constant velocity, and if it's got some initial angular velocity, it just keeps rotating at that angular velocity. But now with this constraint, it moves in a different way. So what's the nature of that constraint? It's called a Slay constraint. And one way of thinking about this constraint is it says the dot product of the velocity of this point with this direction has to be zero. So the velocity of this thing, whatever it is, has to be that direction. And one way of saying that is that its component in that direction has to be zero. So if you write that out in components, you get this equation. It says that these variables that describe the configuration of this, which is where is this point on the plane and what angle does it have, are restricted by this equation, that the velocity components and the direction multiplied together have to add up somehow. So that's called a constraint. The motion is constrained that way. And this is called a non-holonomic constraint. Why is it called a non-holonomic constraint? It's because non-holonomic means not whole. It's a not whole constraint because it can't be integrated to get something like this. So there's no function that you can write of this form, or some function of x, y, and theta equal a constant, or x, y, and theta and a constant equals zero, that when you differentiate it, gives you this. So it's called non-integrable. Means that there's nothing that you can differentiate to get that, so you can't integrate it to get something else. Now, I gave this talk at a meeting in Banff on non-holonomic mechanics, not in 2007, but like 1997. And a guy in the audience said, well, you can't integrate it, but maybe Ramanujan could. And so the question is, could Ramanujan do this problem? And the answer is no, Ramanujan couldn't do it either. And how do you know that? It's because if there was such a function, it would say that this thing was restricted in where it could be. There couldn't be any x, y, and theta that this could take on. But we know from driving cars, again, and parallel parking them, that if I wanted to take this thing and put it over here, I can, because I can do parallel parking and get it over here. And I can turn this at any angle. So it's clear by driving this around, I can be in any place on the plane and at any orientation. So that means there can't be a restriction of this form. So anybody who does math to get from here to there is doing wrong math. So we know it's not integrable just from this physical argument. As opposed to a whole constraint. So this is a constraint on velocities as opposed to velocities and configurations, and it's a half constraint. Here's a restriction on velocities, which is a whole constraint. Why is that? Because if you know, say, that this thing, if there was a constraint of this form, how would you get a constraint of this form? Is you took away this gate and put a pin here and said it had to be in a slot. So it can't move that direction. We'd say x dot is equal to zero. We can integrate that. If x dot is equal to zero, x is equal to a constant. That's a whole constraint. If this is in a pin, can't have x and has no x velocity, then this point is stuck on this line here and we can't have any x, y, and theta. Can only have a limited subset, the subset where this point stays in the slot. So velocity constraints are of two types, integrable and non-integrable. If they're integrable, it's called a holonomic constraint, a whole constraint. If it's not, it's called a non-holonomic constraint. So one feature of non-holonomic constraints is rather than use this big, hard-to-understand mathy language of non-integrable, is that the number of variables which describe the configurations is a bigger number than the number of variables that describe the number of velocities. So this thing, at one instant in time, it can have a velocity in that direction and an angular velocity, and that's all, two numbers. Whereas where can it be? It could be at any x, y, and theta, three numbers. Three is bigger than two. The system is non-holonomic. What's an experiment you can do? Again, it's a parking lot experiment. If you take casters and you lubricate them well, they become equivalent to frictionless pads. And there's a rear wheel, and this thing then is happy to go straight forwards. That's with the frictionless. But you push it backwards, it doesn't like it. It pops around and goes the other way. Okay, so this is another grocery store parking lot experiment you can do, and it's easy to do. And you do it in the parking lot, not in the aisles. Now, who's done this experiment? Okay, so some of you have done it. So this one, it should have told you the answer to the car experiment, right? It's the same problem, right? because this thing, it's not actually frictionless. It's just kind of an isotropic friction. Locked wheels, when they slide, are isotropic friction, the same force in different direction. Rolling wheels is anisotropic friction. So this is the braked car problem again. Okay, so how I really got interested in this as a topic was getting into bicycles. And we have a web page, and then this will take you to another web page in Delft, and we have lots of stuff about bicycles. Here's some drawings made by Arne Schwab in Delft of a bicycle. What do you think of a bicycle as? Is four rigid objects connected with three hinges. One object, two objects, three objects, four objects, one hinge, two hinge, three hinges. Two of the objects are discs, which you imagine roll with a point contact. They have knife edge contact. They're toroids with infinitesimal radius, so you think of them as flat discs. And then these rigid objects, you think of them as arbitrary within the symmetry requirements, like they're same left-right symmetric. And if you want to draw it in some arbitrary configuration, this is tricky to draw this. Probably 30, 40 hours went into that picture. So these are kind of the assumptions that go into the model. Lots of people have worked in this on the mechanics of this bicycle. There are different ways of trying to derive the equations of motion and linearize them. Somewhere in there comes this non-holonomic contact. This is sort of the linearized version of that equation I just showed you before. In the end, you get this equation here. And what this is meant to represent is two coupled second-order linear differential equations. So Q is two numbers. It's the lean angle and the steer angle. This is some 2x2 matrix, That's the speed of the bicycle. That's the gravity constant, another 2x2 matrix, the speed squared, 2x2 matrix, equals some forcing. And this is how hard you turn the handlebars, and this is how hard some wind is tipping the bicycle sideways. Since about 1897, about 30 people have tried to write these equations, and almost everyone gets them wrong. So we tried to write this very careful paper about 3 years ago, getting the right equations and checking. So not only do they get them wrong, almost nobody compares with anybody else, because the equations, even though they look simple here, each of these matrices, each element of each of these matrices is some big formula involving moments of inertia and lengths and angles and so on. It's very hard to compare the equations. So what do you get out of these equations? And this result was basically in hand in about 97. That's 1897, is that if you roll a bicycle at some speed, if it's fast enough but not too fast, all of the eigenvalues have negative real parts. So this is the real parts of the eigenvalues, the dotted lines are the imaginary parts as a function of speed. And if you just take those equations and look at the eigenvalues, so this is kind of a parameter sweep. It's a kind of a root locus plot, but it's showing the eigenvalues as a function of a parameter, rather than the trajectory on a complex plane. But here's this region where you have one eigenvalue with a huge negative part, two other parts with negative parts. One of these is complex. Which one is complex? This one is complex. So this is a complex pair with this plus or minus this imaginary part and two real roots. So it's four roots, and they all have negative real parts. This is the bicycle is self-stable in this region. And this is a fact that I guess some people know and some people don't. But in case you doubt this fact, here is a bicycle. It comes from my barn. This is getting sounds. And here it is rolling by itself. Now, this bicycle is a little too stable. So the basic features of a normal bicycle are here, but this one's a little more stable. And the reason is the forks are bent around backwards, which makes it a little more stable. But we're going to make a new video with a normal bicycle that does that. So why is a bicycle stable? So one explanation is the equations say so, and the equations seem to be about right, but there's nothing to say that maybe there's a simple explanation. So there are sort of historically simple explanations for why a bike is stable, and the two famous ones are that it's something about gyroscopes, and that explanation goes back to the mid-19th century, and as best we can tell, until maybe 1910, nobody had articulated sort of a reasonable explanation of the gyroscopic aspect of bicycle stability. So the simple explanation is that you've got spinning parts, and when you have things which spin, they just like to keep their orientation. So for example, if you take a rolling wheel, we'll take a top and spin it. It likes to keep its orientation. It stays up. If you take a top and spin it and put it on a frictionless plane, it still balances if it's spinning fast enough. If you take a rolling wheel balances, so everybody knows that, and they knew that, I don't know, in 1850 or so. And it's sort of like, it seems like it's sort of a gyroscopic effect, and it is largely that. For example, this rolling wheel in space likes to keep its orientation, and if you put it on a frictionless plane, it still keeps its orientation. But that's when we, and we means mostly my friend Jim Papadopoulos, who was working on this at Cornell in 1985 or so, look at the equations. We couldn't see a special place for the gyroscope. Now, another explanation for stability of a bicycle is this thing called the trail. And what people do is they look at this steering axis, and they look at this point of contact, and they say this whole front wheel is sort of like the front wheel of that grocery cart, and it sort of drags behind the steering axis. And somehow that gives a bicycle stability. So that's probably the most famous theory. There's a paper in Physics Today by David Jones in 1970. It was republished by Physics Today verbatim in 2006, giving this this trail theory of stability. And again, if you look in the equations, we couldn't find a special place for that trail. And then Jim played around, and he found a design of a bicycle. And since then, we found a variety of others that have no gyroscope in them at all. And they don't have this trail, and they still balance themselves. And then we tried to build it at Cornell, failed, and we tried again and failed. And then Delft, they tried. And last year, they were much more careful and systematic in building it. So here's a bicycle that has no gyroscopic effect, and it has no trail, and it balances itself. So it can't be that gyroscopes and trail are necessary for bicycle stability, because here's a bicycle that doesn't have either. And how do I say it has no gyroscopic effect? It's got little wheels, which have very small angular momentum, and they come in pairs. With each wheel, there's a second wheel that counterspins, so there's no spin angular momentum. Okay, so that's sort of the non-holonomic story, which is half of my talk. So now I want to go on to the other use of the word non-holonomic in mechanics. So before I go on, any questions about stuff I talked about so far? Yes?
So
what's the main reason is a question that I don't know. So they say, what are necessary, what does it take for a bicycle to balance? And so what we know it takes, we say, what are necessary conditions? We look in the equations, can we find necessary conditions for stability? So one necessary condition is that it has to be that in the equations there's some coupling between leaning and steering. Leaning has to cause steering. So then you say, what are the different mechanical effects by which leaning can cause steering? One of them is gyroscopic precession. That's this famous gyroscopic explanation. One of them is this trail. If the wheel is dragging behind the steering axis, and you push sideways on the wheel, it tends to steer the bike. So that's another coupling. But those are not the only two couplings. There's other couplings. For example, the main coupling in this gyro-free bike is that the center of mass of the front assembly is low, and say here. The center of mass of the rear frame is high and back here. When this bike falls, this wants to fall faster than that does. But it can't because it's stuck on this hinge. As it tries to fall faster, this tips. So that's the coupling, which we think is the major thing in this. There's not a way of saying what the major term is. There are other things. For example, there's the moment of inertia is not a scalar. There's products of inertia, and the products of inertia couple leaning to steering, both in the rear frame and the front. In the front frame, it's direct. Leaning causes steering if you have the moment of inertia is not a vertical or like this, or along the steering axis and perpendicular. And the rear frame, if there's a coupling between leaning, if there's products of inertia, it gives a sideways force, which then through this trail can give some coupling. Does that answer your question? So the other simple statement about bicycle stability is a property of a bicycle which is self-stable is that if you hold it in a steady turn to the right, and it's balanced and in a steady turn to the right, the torque you have to apply to the handlebars has to be to the left. So you have to, if I'm turning, here's this bike, I've steered it to the right, I'm in circles, I have to push with my right hand on the right handlebar to hold in that circle. If the bicycle doesn't have that property, it cannot be self-stable. Having that property doesn't make it self-stable, but that's a necessary property for self-stability. Now, what comes into that is a whole mess of terms, all these gyroscopic terms and so on. Yes?
The equations you derived for stability, are they only for the bike being vertical, traveling straight, or does it take into account turning?
The simple answer is it's small motions near to straight ahead. So the equations are linearized about straight-ahead motion. So you could imagine linearizing about other solutions, like some circular motion. Then you say, what circular motion? Are there circular motions with no torque on the handlebars? And it turns out there are, but you have to look at the solution of the nonlinear equations, which is not my department. Okay, does that address your question? Okay, so now I want to go into this other use of the word non-holonomic, which is this falling cat problem. So this problem goes back to Mari. I think people have claimed it goes back, there's some Greek observation. I haven't really looked into the history. But Mari was one of the first makers of motion pictures. He made movies about the same time as that horse guy. What's the name of the horse guy?
Moybridge.
Moybridge, right. So the these are sort of contemporaries, but he also did animals. And so this is an 1894 video of a cat falling. And the cat problem is you take a cat and you hold it still and upside down and you let go of it. And it has, in this initial condition, a configuration which is not desirable for being on the ground. It's upside down. And it's got zero angular momentum. And it can't touch anything. And you think air is light and there's not much to react against. So it's upside down and it wants to land on its feet. And it does. And this is a video of the cat doing that. And you can do this at home. It's not that bad. They do it easily, so it doesn't work out to be a cruel experiment. How do they do it? So it seems like a paradox. So people have thought about it this way and that. So there was a magazine that had the gauge theory of the falling cat. I don't even know what gauge theory is. So the puzzle is that it's got zero angular momentum all the time, yet it turns over, which is a paradox. And the word paradox is an oxymoron, because we think we live in a rational universe, and there can't be contradictions. So the word of paradox means apparent paradox. So there's some apparent contradiction. It's got zero angular momentum and it turns over. And so that's the famous puzzle. And there are various ways of thinking about that. So before I try and resolve this puzzle, let me try and set it up so it looks like a paradox, even though there's no such thing as a paradox. What's the setup that makes you think that this is a paradox is this sort of parallel that you learn in freshman physics between linear motion and rotary motion. So in linear motion, you have F equals ma, which says force is rate of change of L, linear momentum. In the rotary case, you have torque is I alpha, which says that the torque is rate of change of angular momentum. If the force is zero, then the rate of change of linear momentum is zero, which means the linear momentum is a constant. If the linear momentum is constant and is zero, so you take something which is still to start with, and you don't apply a force to it, it doesn't move. Something is still. It's got zero angular momentum. There's no force applied to it. Its velocity is zero. It doesn't go anywhere. So you can integrate the linear momentum equation to get that if something starts out still, you integrate, like I was talking about integrating before, to get that the position is a constant. And in the rotary case, If the torque is equal to zero, the angular momentum is a constant. If the angular momentum starts out zero, say you have zero initial angular velocity, and the torque is zero, then the angle is a constant. So the cat can't turn over. That's the paradox. Okay, now cat does turn over, so I lied to you somehow or other here. Right? Gravity is not the resolution of this, because gravity force is always equivalent to a single force acting on the center of mass, which applies no torque to the system relative to the center of mass. So there's no rate of change of angular momentum relative to the center of mass. So let's do it again and realize that a cat is not a particle. So the more general theory of cats is that they're made of collections of particles. and go through the math again. So then you have the sum of forces is the sum over all the particles of the mass times the rate of change of velocity. And you can pull the derivative out, and you get that the sum of the forces external on the system is the rate of change of the linear momentum of the system, assuming the internal forces cancel, which is that's one of the basic assumptions we live by, all of us. So if the linear momentum is zero to start with, and you have no force, then that tells you that this quantity here is a constant, but this quantity here is the location of the center of mass multiplied by the mass, which is a constant. So it says the center of mass can't move. So if you apply no forces to a system, and the system center of mass has zero velocity to start with, it can't go anywhere. Now you try to do the same derivation in the angular world, and the derivation fails. So what happens is you say, here's the torques, R cross F, external on the system. And they're the sum over all the particles of R cross MA. And you can pull this derivative out. It doesn't look like you can, but if you use the product rule, the other term disappears. So if you differentiate this, you get two terms, one of which is this and the other which is zero. And this thing you define to be the rate of change of angular momentum. So the concept of angular momentum comes from this integration of this MA torque equation. And you find out that this thing is d by dt of this thing. You call this thing angular momentum, and we say the rate of change of that is zero if the force is zero. So if the torques on the system are zero, for the falling cat they are, the angular momentum is zero to start with because you let go of the cat still. It says that this quantity is zero, which says what about the configuration of the cat? So this equivalent thing said that this thing was a constant. This says that what's a constant? And the answer is there is no what. So there is no quantity that angular momentum is the derivative of. There is linear momentum is the derivative of center of mass position times the total mass. Angular momentum isn't the derivative of anything. Now, maybe Ramanujan could figure out what angular momentum is the derivative of, but I know that he can't because the cat turns over. So our failure to do this derivation makes us think maybe you can exploit that failure, and that's the simple explanation of how does a cat turn over is there's no reason it shouldn't. Right? Now you say, well, how does it do it? Then you've got to say this pushes this that way, and that goes this way, that way. But there is no paradox because there's no reason you should think that the cat shouldn't be able to tip over. So linear momentum balance, we can say force causes translation. Angular momentum balance, you like to think torque causes rotation, and it's just not so simple because you can rotate with no torque. The cat does it. So let me show you some demonstrations of this. The coolest demonstration, which is totally successful, is this to do the cat experiment with human beings. And so Tom Kane, again, he's actually the author of one of the Falling Cat papers. He had a graduate student who turned into an astronaut. And so instead of just dropping the person, you throw them into space, and you see what they do out there. So this is a video from Skylab and of a Tom Kane student showing the falling cat stuff. So you get in the middle there. Let's see. There's, by the way, if you, there's some really nonsense Skylab videos, so I'm not saying they're all. The lighting is not good. Can you see this very well? Can we turn off the lights here? I think it would be way easier to see. So it looks like he can't turn over, but then there he is. He turns over. He's got no angular momentum. Right, there's no paradox there, and sort of that makes sense. It's like a reaction wheel spinning one way, and he spins the other, and the angular momentum adds to zero. And then there are more subtle things you can do to turn around. And then the fun part is he tries, he gets sick of this, and he tries to swim away, and he can't. Right? So without touching the environment, you can do rotary locomotion by just internal distortions, but you cannot do linear locomotion. Okay, then there's more and more videos. There's a video that I've seen, some people pointed to me on YouTube, of angular momentum demonstrations with CD disc spinning and so on. Has anybody seen that one? It's total nonsense. Just total nonsense. So don't believe everything you see in Skylab. Let's say you want to demonstrate this at home, and you don't want to drop cats and drop people, and you don't have the wherewithal to throw yourself into space or somebody else into space. So you'd like to do some sort of two-dimensional version of this. And so there are gadgets around for doing these demonstrations. And so one of them is like this frictionless plate. And the problem with these demonstrations is that they have too much friction. So what happens is, without doing any of the tricks that the cat does, I can turn myself by turning the friction on and off. So I'm not actually using, if I was doing this in space, I wouldn't turn. Because what happens is, when I turn my upper body relative to my lower body would go the other way, but that's not happening. My lower body is frozen by that little bit of friction, and then I jerk around it like this. And so demonstrations with these kinds of platforms go bad. So you'd like to think they're better platforms. And there are these expensive platforms like this one. And you can, on YouTube, you can see demonstrations here of sort of conservation of angular momentum. So for example, you take a bicycle wheel and you spin it up. This is a rigged bicycle wheel again. It's too heavy. And the idea is this system has angular momentum that direction. If I go like this, suddenly it's got angular momentum that direction. Now, if I'm standing on this platform and this has a good bearing, it can't apply any torques about this axis. So if the wheel's spinning this way, I've got to spin the other way. So that's the sort of the demonstration that, you know, one of the demonstrations you can see on YouTube or in physics classes with this thing. So to get this thing spinning, I stand on this thing really still, and then I turn this. And then to keep this net system angular momentum zero, I sort of have to spin the other way as this one does. But what you see is this one doesn't work very well either. And the problem with this one is that in all of these sort of experiments, you neglect the fact that there are all these vortex fields. And so, like this room, the wiring is clockwise around. And if you tap into that vortex field, you can build up angular momentum. Now, the thing is that if you practice, there's, you know, the electrons are going one way, but the current is going the other way, and you can tap into the other vortex field, and you can build up angular momentum the other way too. So it's all these explanations, you know, neglecting this vortex field, and that's part of the angular momentum balance equation, right? Okay, so what's going on in that experiment? Who thinks they know? Okay, go for it. Say, listen, you're not allowed to know. I wrote you an email how this one works. you're disqualified. We had a whole correspondence that you were part of about that. Wait a second, but you're not allowed to answer. It's like cheating on the test. Anybody else? Yeah. Right, so the axis is tilted a little bit. So what this is, weasel ball is like one analogy. Another one is like a rat cage. Let me just pretend I'm using this. is heavy when I'm actually using this. Okay, so imagine that you have a squirrel cage, they call it, or a rat cage, and a rat's on the inside, and it runs up the side and it turns this around. So if the axis of this was horizontal, you would have no trouble with running around and causing this to spin. Now I tip it a little bit, it still works. Now when it's like this, if it's got good bearings, it still works. And if I do it like this, and it's only tipped 1 degree, and it has very good bearings, it still works. So what was happening when I was doing that is you put this on the floor in a random spot. No floor is flat, it's tipped a degree or so. And I figured out before the lecture that downhill was that way. So I leaned to this side, and it falls this way. And then I kept then I leaned again to that side, and it falls this way, and I build up speed as if I was running around a rat cage like this. And in the opposite vortex field, I leaned over there and ran around like this. And instead of running around, I adjusted my lean here. When I was like this, I was leaning there, and when I was like this, I was leaning there. I always leaned to the same side in the physical room, so it's always falling downhill. Okay, now, I was trying to do that, but even if I wasn't trying to do that, I would do that. So when I did that first experiment with the bicycle wheel, you might have noticed that I had this thing and I was still, and I turned like this, and I went like this, and I turned like this, and I was still turning. And if you look on YouTube or see any of your physics teachers do this demonstration, unless they're very careful and have these and level the thing out, but even this product doesn't even come with levels, they all screw up. So you see people and they go like this on YouTube and they say this, and I go like this, and the anger minimum is like this, and then I turn it back, and thus proving conservation of anger momentum. So I thought, we can do better than that. Conservation of bicycle wheels. So what if we make a self-leveling version of that? Pick up my daughter from daycare. A self-leveling version of that. So I hung this thing in our ceiling and got this dog leash thing, which has a bearing in it, and thought, well, here's this thing, and I can hang it from a hook in the ceiling. Now, gravity's going to be pointing down. The person's going to be hanging under this. Center of mass has to be under here. They've got this bearing up here, which can't apply torques about this axis. It's self-aligning. I can do the experiment with this device. So I'm going to tell this story out of order, and I'm going to show you what should have happened when I did that experiment. So here's, you should jump up on this thing, and you do the cat move, and you turn one way, and you do the other cat move, and you turn the other way. And so this is the cat experiment with the self-aligning bearing, and then you don't know quite what happened at the end, right? Hopefully it wasn't spinning at the end. So I set this up in my living room, and I had my daughter do it first, but here's my wife. So she hangs there, and I explained to her how the cat does this thing by bending its body around like this, and there's two effects which cancel, which makes the body look like it's turning. And she does it. I made those pajamas. So she turns around. Her net angular momentum at this point, at the beginning of the experiment, this is going backwards. So looking down, you would think she has a clockwise angular momentum because you look at her legs. But if you look at her upper body, there's a counterclockwise angular momentum, and those two are adding up to about zero. So that's how the cat turns around. It's these two effects. One is this angular momentum of the body looking at it as a stick along the axis of the body, which gives you a clockwise looking down, and one is a rotation of the body about its own axis, which is counterclockwise. And both the upper and lower body have that. So there's little asymmetry in here because she's hanging. With the cat, it's more symmetric. Both the front and back of the cat do the same thing. So if you look at just one half of the cat, here's the cat. In the two parts of the cat does this bending move, and it bends like this, and it tries to bend its body around like this. But as you look at this, you see a clockwise angular momentum. So it only can add to zero if there's a counterclockwise momentum of the body on top of that. So the cat does this thing which looks clockwise to you, and superposed on that has to be this rotation counterclockwise to keep the total angular momentum zero. So she's successfully showing this, moving right along. And then she's supposed to stop. Now, when she stops, her angular momentum is supposed to be zero, like the guy in Skylab, right? But what happens is she goes around, and she says, after about four times, she says, this is getting hard. And there she is with zero angular momentum at the end. So what went wrong in that experiment? What? So you could think it's twisting up the rope, and actually I had an antagonistic audience when I gave this talk a few months ago, and I had to do an experiment to prove that that was not the case. I said, it's not the case, and he said, well, all your other experiments messed up, why not this one? And I said, but I understand this one. And he said, yeah, but you thought you understood the other ones. So... I just did this experiment a few weeks ago. So here, if you look at the top, there's not a lot of twist there. Just pay attention to the top. And just to be careful about it, you think something is being wound up at the top. So you, this is my daughter holding her still. There's nothing being wound up there. Okay, so that's not the explanation, despite what Michael Goldfarb said. So. Here is the thing itself. So is there friction in that thing? Yes. Okay, so now what does that do for you? Right, it's kind of like that, but it's a slightly different order of events here. So what's happening is there's a little friction in that bearing, and so she is turning, looking down at her clockwise. This is the held at the end one. That's not the interesting one, sorry. Looking down at her, she's turning counterclockwise. So there's a clockwise frictional torque acting on the system. And it's acting this whole time. So that means that the whole time she's doing this supposedly frictionless experiment, and she's demonstrating these counter-rotating things. The top of her body is going one way, and there's a torque the other way. Angular momentum is torque times time, or integral of torque with respect to time. So when you get towards the end of this experiment, her body isn't turning much anymore. Going back a few frames, I'm going backwards now. Now I'll go forwards. This is the end of the experiment. So looking down on this, what you see is the legs have a big clockwise angular momentum. The body has no counterclockwise momentum. The system has a big clockwise momentum. What is that? There's two ways to think about it. One is it's the angular momentum of her leg spinning around. The other way to think of it is it's the frictional torque, which was fighting her body turning. The system, remember, had approximately zero angular momentum for the beginning experiment, but their upper body is turning. So it's the integral of torque with respect to time gives, at this point in the motion, the angular momentum of her legs. Then she freezes her body. All that angular momentum goes into her rigid body, and then it gets spent like this. Okay, so now what does theory say about this? Let's just do, there's a little calculation you can do. So, here is the torque on the system. It's the rate of change of angular momentum. Here is the angular velocity of her upper part of her body. Not the angular velocity of the whole thing. The whole thing doesn't make sense. She's not a rigid object. And this is saying there's a frictional torque, which is proportional to the angular velocity on that bearing. The frictional torque, then, is equal to the rate of change of angular momentum. This equation you can integrate, and it says the net change in angle of her upper body has to be the net change of angular momentum of the system in the experiment. But at the very beginning of the experiment, her angular momentum is zero. She's just hanging there. And after all said and done, and everything's come to rest, her angular momentum is zero, which means there's no change in angular momentum, which means the total rotation of the system should be zero. So then you look at the experiment again, and you count. how many times does she go around one way and how many times does she go around the other way? So one, two, three, four, just barely. I can't do it anymore, let me stop. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, seven and a half. So the theory says she should turn back four times because the net change in angular momentum is zero. Therefore, the net angle her upper body twist should be zero. What was wrong with the theory? What? Okay, so that theory didn't say anything about the moment of inertia and how it changed in time. It was just the torque integrated in time is gives you the total rotation, is proportional to the total rotation. The problem is that the friction law there assumed linear viscous friction. And that's wrong. This is more like a dry friction. And the accumulation of angular momentum, for linear viscous friction, the angular momentum you get is proportional to the displacement. In this case, it's the rotary displacement. And if you have, for linear motion, a dashpot, you think of it as a force per unit velocity, but it's also an impulse per unit displacement. And in rotation, it's the same thing. This isn't linear viscous friction. So what happens is towards the end of the experiment, she's barely rotating, but you still have that dry friction, so the torque is almost constant. So while at the end, while it looks like she's doing nothing, she's building up more and more angular momentum because it's dry friction. And so then she gets to spend more, and this theory, this linear viscous theory is wrong. But this linear viscous theory is interesting in itself because it says if you had linear viscous friction, you can't turn. So the beginning of the falling cat problem was that if you have zero angular momentum, you can turn. Now, if any part of your body is connected to linear viscous friction, you can't turn at all. So the ability to locomote is totally killed by linear viscous friction, no matter how small it is. So then you say that doesn't make sense, because we already said when there's zero torque on the system, you can turn. Now we say we have this math derivation, that math is right. There's no fast ones in that math. That math is correct math. It says that the net turn, if there's any linear viscous friction on any part of the system, you can't turn at all, even in the limit as you get to zero. When you get exactly to zero, you can turn again. But if it's 0.00001, you can't turn. Now, how can it be that you don't get to that limit in some smooth way? Yes? Yes. So the inability to turn depends on the linear friction.
And it depends on there only being
linear. Only linear friction. So if the only friction is linear friction, you can't turn, no matter how small. So let me just resolve this paradox so I can finish up here. Is that what happens is it's true, from beginning to end, you can't turn no matter how small the friction is. It's just that it takes 100 years. So at the end of the experiment, she'll have a little bit of angular momentum. She'll have to spend it back. It'll look like she's doing the frictionless experiment. And then you look carefully and you see she's slowly turning back. And after 100 years, you'll see she's come back to zero displacement. So you get this for any finite time as friction goes to zero, the frictionless case approaches the frictional case as friction goes to zero approaches the frictionless case. When you go to infinite time, there are two distinct things. The friction case, no matter how small, is different from the frictionless case. Okay. Now, there's one last experiment, which is I went to this non-holonomic conference and wanted to show this stuff off. And I didn't have these videos with me, so I went to reproduce them. And I bought a good bearing. And while other people were skiing at this conference, I was doing this experiment in the gym. And I got these high school players, basketball players, to do this experiment with, like so. And I wanted to show this spin back thing because I wanted to show it to the gauge theory of the falling cat guy who was at the meeting. I know something about angular momentum too, you know. So I got this guy to do this thing. This is some random guy. And he says, oh man, I'm building up my angular momentum. I said, no, you're not. It's the opposite of that. He says, no, I'm building up my angular momentum. I said, no, you're not. I said, I'm the professor. I said, I'm really going, you're the basketball player. You don't. He says, no, I'm really building up my angular momentum. So I said, just stop and then you'll see you spin back. And so he... after a while, he stopped. And he was building up his anger momentum. So where did that come from? So you could think he was pumping the friction. That would depend on actually stopping and starting. So he's always sliding in one direction. So the friction, torque, is always fighting the net angular momentum he has in the end. So there's never at any instant in time a helpful friction torque. Other theory? Okay, so I'll just give it away. This took me days to figure out. So I thought, this is not right. So I got a different basketball player. And I thought, well, maybe there's an air circulation here, and I got to spin the other way. And then I tried it. And I still didn't get it. And then I thought about it, put the experiment away, went to bed. I couldn't really sleep. Then the next day, I came back and set it up again, and the same thing happened with other basketball players. And then I figured it out. So I'm not as good as it as that guy, but
it's because it's swinging
side to side. Which way did I swing? Oh, I swung back that time. Okay, I have a different one where it swings. Andy spins. Sorry, I got the wrong one. This law of conservation of angular momentum holds it relative to the center of mass. And for these swinging experiments, we're doing it relative to the support point. But to conserve angular momentum about some support point, the only law we know is that that support point has to be stationary. So if you look carefully at the video, you'll see at the top, the way I hung it is I hung it from two strings up there. So looking at this upside down, it was swinging like this. And what happens is you can swing sideways. You can jerk your body to get a force one way on this side, jerk your body to get a force this way on this side. Relative to this fictitious point, stationary point in the middle, you can build up angular momentum by this other complicated move. Now, clearly those basketball players had taken courses in mechanics and solved this problem and figured out. So they hadn't, right? So to me, this is like the most interesting thing, is that basically these random people in about 4 seconds figured out this thing that I couldn't figure out in 4 hours. So it's that we are very good at extracting sort of information about how mechanics works in our environment. Here, they were trying to turn, and they figured out how to do it very fast, and lots of people did. So that was the big punchline, which I think is relevant to how people move and animals move and so on, is that we're all much smarter below our ears than we are above our ears. Okay, so that's my talk.